Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2444.
Thanks to everyone who made the WILL sweepstakes a win-win project. 11 lucky listeners won fabulous prizes, all donated by our generous sponsors, and people contributed more than $50,000 to help WILL continue to provide valuable programming and resources for the community. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. We have to give him some time off every once in a while. Our producers are Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Travis Stanzel with production assistance. And at the controls this morning, Jason Croft. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we'll do something we do once a month on Focus 580, talk about personal finance. Our guest, as always, David Sino, professor of finance at the University of Illinois. David, we'll begin by talking about some of the things that are going on with the economy and how they affect people, and then we'll open up the phone lines and take your questions. We're glad to have David with us. He has a wide range of experience and expertise, actually amazing range, I should say. He's licensed real estate. He's got a Juris Doctorate. He's a personal financial certified consultant. He is quite an amazing person and stays in touch with everything that's going on with the economy. So we'll give our best shot at whatever questions you want to throw at us. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us. That is 800-222-9455, and I'll repeat those numbers throughout the hour. And David Sino, thanks once again for joining us.
Well, good morning, Jack, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to take a few moments this morning and revisit some basic gift and estate tax planning rules, and additionally then discuss the hottest estate planning technique for individuals with net worths really in excess of $1.5 million or $2 million, excluding their tax-deferred investments. First, let's start with some basic rules about transferring wealth by gifting. Now, the first rule is that an individual can gift tax-free the sum of $11,000 annually to as many people as he or she desires. So, for example, Jack, you could gift $11,000 today or perhaps tomorrow, if you wanted to wait until tomorrow, to each and every staff member of WILL entirely tax-free. Now, there is no income tax impact. There is no gift tax on you or the recipient of your largesse. Additionally, a married couple could jointly gift $22,000 to as many people as they desire. Again, no tax on the donor or the recipient donee. So these gifts, remember, could also be made annually. It's not just one time that you make this $11,000. Why, you could do this every year. Now, in previous programs, we also covered the special rule in which a parent or perhaps a grandparent could gift as much as $55,000 entirely gift tax and income tax free to a child or a grandchild for college education funding, pursuant to a Section 529 plan. And finally, in addition to our annual exclusion of $11,000 per person, we as individuals can gift additionally tax-free another $1 million during our lifetime with no tax impact, no gift tax, no income taxes. Now, once we gift that money, and let's say that someone is nice enough to gift it to me, which I will happily accept, and then I reinvest the money and I earn dividends or I earn interest from that money, then the interest and the dividends would be subject to federal income tax. All right, now let's review some very basic estate tax rules. First, for anyone passing away this year, the estate will not be subject to estate tax so long as the estate value is $1.5 million or less. That's the magic number this year. And that, of course, really covers most Americans. However, estates valued at more than $1.5 million, interestingly enough, the very next incremental dollar is taxed for estate tax purposes at 45%. And indeed, the estate tax rate quickly escalates to 48 cents on the dollar, 48%. So estates valued at perhaps $5 million, $7 million, $10 million or more are seeing close to one-half the value ending up in the government coffers. This obviously is one mechanism for redistribution of wealth. Now, as you obviously can imagine, wealthy families just hate this result. So they often give substantial portions of their estate to charitable causes. Indeed, that's quite wonderful, as assets left to bona fide charitable organizations are not subject to estate taxes. That's very important. And indeed, when the estate tax rules were recently revised just a couple of years ago, some of the wealthiest people in the country, for example, Bill Gates, was very concerned about reducing estate tax rates as this may reduce the amount of charitable giving. And so Bill Gates, as wealthy as he is quite charitable-minded, obviously, and was concerned that by reducing estate tax rates too much, we might actually reduce the amount of charitable contributions made on behalf of wealthy individuals. Now, interestingly enough, states have jumped in and promulgated legislation which allows wealthy families to entirely avoid federal estate taxes forever. How about that? And this particular legislation is the creation of statutes which provides for something called dynasty trusts. Remember that term, dynasty trusts. Sometimes it's referred to as perpetual trusts. Until recently, all trusts where folks left money in trust really had to terminate. Typically, if we thought about it in terms of years, most trusts terminated within a 60-year period of time. And at that point in time, the proceeds were distributed and often they were taxed for federal estate taxes at that time. So then the trust would be subject to estate tax. However, today, if a trust is set up as this so-called dynasty trust, the principal of the trust can continue to grow estate tax-free forever. That's right, forever. And the income and the dividends generated by the trust can be distributed each year to, say, family beneficiaries. Now, the income and the dividends distributed to the beneficiaries are, of course, subject to federal income tax each year. But the underlying trust asset, and indeed the growth in that underlying trust asset, is not subject to estate tax. Let's take an example. Grandfather's estate plan provides for the deposit of a, let's say, $1.5 million diversified portfolio of stocks or indexes at grandfather's death. And this deposit or this program goes into something called a dynasty trust. Now, at a growth rate of 6% annually, just in terms of the growth of the value of the stocks, this trust could grow to almost $28 million in 50 years. That's not counting dividends. That's not counting interest. That's just counting a 6% annualized growth rate on $1.5 million where you're not paying tax. And indeed, the $28 million could throw off a lot of income to family beneficiaries. In 100 years, the trust could conceivably grow to $500 million if it continued to compound annually just at 6%. Now, as you can imagine, these trusts are rather complex, and indeed they are, shall we say, expensive to draft. A typical attorney who really knows their business and knows what they're doing will charge somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 to draft one of these animals, depending on their complexity. And get this, Illinois is one of the 18 states that allows for the creation of a dynasty trust. And this particular kind of dynasty trust in Illinois can last forever. Interestingly enough, Alaska was one of the first states providing for the creation of the dynasty trust concept. Also, some dynasty trusts are set up with incentive provisions for the beneficiaries. For example, if I knew that I was the beneficiary of one of these very, very large dynasty trusts, maybe I wouldn't be so interested in working so hard, especially if I was a trust fund baby earning lots of interest and dividends. Perhaps I would do even more fishing than I do currently. So, for example, a beneficiary may be prohibited from sharing in trust income unless he or she has made a bona fide effort at gainful employment for a certain period of time. Maybe this particular beneficiary must possess a college degree or college equivalent in order to receive distributions from this particular trust. So the maker of the trust, often referred to as a grantor, the grantor can stipulate initially what kinds of provisions are going to apply to these beneficiaries, what kinds of distributions are going to be given or provided for the beneficiaries. So there can be all kinds of rules and regulations that can be built in to this particular example. Now, unfortunately, I apparently am not a beneficiary at this point in time of a dynasty trust, although I would like to be so. So I invite any of our wonderful friends of WILL who are contemplating the creation of a dynasty trust to include David Sino as a beneficiary. And in lieu of David Sino, you could always include my daughters, Renee or Megan. I'd even be happy to provide a Social Security number in that particular case. So there you have it, Jack. I just wonder what is coming next. In any event, I'd be delighted to answer questions about dynasty trusts, trusts in general, or tackle other financial planning questions from our listeners.
Well, very good. That was David Sino. He is our guest this morning. He is professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, and we are delighted to take your questions. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a listener standing by, so let's go ahead and talk with them. This is someone on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Last month in your discussion, I think you had a short discussion about tax reporting for I-bonds and stated that the interest earned each year must be reported for federal income tax purposes. I got a looked up on the Treasury Direct site and found that it said there, on a reporting basis for I-bonds, you may use either the cash basis or accrual basis for reporting interest for federal income tax purposes. Under the cash basis method, federal tax is deferred until the year of final maturity. Under the accrual basis, you report the interest each year as it accrues. So you don't.
So you have a choice.
You have a choice.
That's
right.
Correct. That's correct. And there is a difference between the I-bonds and the inflation index treasury securities. And I might have been referring to the index treasury securities.
Oh, I see. Well,
right.
How are they different? I don't understand that.
Well, they're called TIPS, and they're basically treasuries with a bonus. Your principal is actually tied to inflation. And while inflation is still basically low, it may start inching up as the economy perks up, if indeed the economy is going to perk up. And your return on a TIP comes in two parts, basically. One is a fluctuating return that's based on the inflation rate, and that's paid out at maturity, plus the current yield, which is a fixed return paid out annually. Now, the downside is that you pay taxes on any gains on your principal each year, though you won't get the money until maturity. So as a result, with TIPS, the TIPS are basically utilized in tax-favored accounts such as individual retirement accounts, KEOs, defined contribution plans, defined benefit plans, etc. And sometimes they are actually garnered and purchased through low-cost mutual funds.
Yeah.
So I think when I was talking last time, I was really referring to the tips.
Okay.
And you are correct that you have two choices that you can make, which is either an accrual system or a cash accounting system. And, of course, most people, I would presume, would opt for not reporting the income on an annual basis.
Yeah, well, I bought a couple I-bonds last year and did not report the interest. And, in fact, I didn't get a 1099 form regarding it from the government, which I would imagine I would get.
You're going to get that at the end.
Well, you get that at the end, right.
Yep. They're not going to let you off the hook.
No, I realize that.
No, they won't do that. Well, I appreciate your calling in and clearing up that potential confusion.
Yes. Okay. Well, I enjoy your program a great deal.
Well, thank you so much. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks so much for the call. We have a couple other callers waiting, and we'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if you have addressed what's coming up next month. A change in the banking law called Check 21.
You know, that's going to be a very interesting law. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it, but as I recall from the literature, obviously checks are going to be clearing much quicker. So people who have had this proclivity or this habit of occasionally writing checks without money in the checking account, waiting
at,
for
what,
a day or two.
You looked at me when you were saying that.
No, Jack, okay. I was thinking of other folks,
okay.
Jack.
All right.
In any event, they may find themselves overdrawn. And this becomes a particular problem because, as I understand the new legislation, when you provide the bank with an out-of-state check and you're actually depositing it, it's not a local check, there is no requirement, as I understand it, for the bank to credit your account with that money so that you immediately have bona fide funds. So this may also cause one to overdraw their checking account more quickly. And, of course, in addition, the big number, the big story in this, called Check 21, is the fact that we're no longer going to get our original checks back. Now, a lot of people have not been getting their original checks back for some time. They've really been receiving sort of a photocopy printout of that particular check. But you do have an option, as I understand it, under the new rules to request something called a substitute check. But again, it is not clear whether all banks are going to comply with that substitute check rule. But by having substitute checks, as opposed to simply having just that little photocopy page, you do preserve certain rights in the case that there is fraud, in the case that your account is improperly credited with the proper amount of the check, etc. So this thing is going to unfold, and it's going to be very, very interesting. It doesn't strike me as particularly consumer-friendly. Have you looked into this yourself?
I have looked mostly at what has been explained on the Consumers Reports website, which I can cite to you if you like.
Sure. Why don't you give that for the benefit of all of our listeners?
It is www.consumersunion.org/finance/CKCLEAR1002. .htm.
So that's www.consumersunion.org/finance/CKClear1002.htm.
That is correct.
Okay. And that's the Consumer Union's nonprofit website. And I know that it does talk about Check 21. And I've forgotten, it goes into effect at the end of October.
October 28th.
October 28th. Okay. Okay.
Apparently, there are some things, well, like you said, for people like me, which I gather is about 40% of the bank customers still get their canceled checks back, and we won't. I know our particular bank is not offering to automatically replace all our old canceled checks with the substitute checks. There's a 10-day recredit requirement in there, but I have seen nothing about when that 10 days starts, if it starts from the time that the check is improperly cleared.
Or the time you receive your statement or whatever. That's an ambiguity, certainly, in the legislation.
And even then, if you don't get your originals back, you can't do anything about it. It's very difficult to prove alterations or fraud.
Yes, so. And as I understand it, the checks may well be destroyed anywhere along the chain, so long as the destroying institution basically has the data processing services to reproduce a so-called substitute check. Is that your understanding?
I believe that's what the Consumers Union website says, yes. My own opinion, if I may offer an editorial comment, is I think that this new law, Check 21, is more of a bank welfare and liability protection act than anything.
Well, again, I haven't looked at it in all of its particularity, but I, from what I have cursorily read about it, I'm not disagreeing with you. It certainly makes things easier for the bank. It certainly would make it less expensive and costly for the bank, and they should reap some additional profits. I don't believe there is anything in the legislation which suggests that the increased efficiencies that banks will glean, hence more profits, will somehow be passed on to customers.
Not a word that I know of.
Not a word about that. So maybe we better be shareholders in these banks.
And the interesting thing is that despite the article that was in the News Gazette earlier this week, most people I've talked to have never heard of this.
Well, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. Unless you're into the banking system or that you are a savvy consumer like yourself, you probably really haven't paid a lot of attention to this particular legislation. But it's going to be a wake-up call for a lot of folks when they get their November statements and the checks are no longer in their statements. Mm-hmm. Now, banks have sent out information ahead of time. I know my particular banks have sent out information telling me, really on one page, that I'm no longer going to receive my checks. And I guess I'm one of those old-fashioned folks, grew up in the 50s and 60s, where I sort of like touching and feeling my checks.
I understand what you're saying. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling in. A pleasure visiting with you.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, we are just about at our midpoint here with David Sinnott, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, taking your questions on personal finance. We have a couple callers waiting and time for plenty of others. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up, another Champaign caller on line number 2. Good morning.
Hi. Regarding the $11,000 donations on an annual basis, do you have to keep any record keeping of that whatsoever? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
The answer is that there is nothing in the law that says that you must keep records. However, if you are audited, it would be intelligent and wise to have a record. Now, there are a variety of ways to accomplish this $11,000 gift. Obviously, the simplest is to write a check. So then you would have sort of a permanent record, but I guess after October 28th, you might have to have a substitute check or alternatively keep the information from the bank. Now, remember that you can make gifts of securities, you can make gifts of real estate, but all of those have certain other consequences, and let me just go through those very, very quickly for you. Let's say that you wanted to make an $11,000 gift to a child, and you had some securities that were worth $11,000, so you had them retitled or transferred into your child's account. Well, if you are gifting appreciated securities to a family member, then that family member, even though they're worth $11,000, their tax basis in that particular security is the cost, what you paid for those securities, or their fair market value at the date that you transfer the securities, whichever is less. So if you transferred $11,000 of IBM stock and you had paid $5,000 for that stock, your transferee, your child, for example, would have a $5,000 basis in that stock. If they later turned around and sold the stock for $11,000, then they have a capital gain, of which they would have to report tax on, of $6,000. So they'd pay tax on a capital gain of $6,000. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to necessarily gift appreciated securities to family members or relatives, you're really better off giving cash. Does that make sense?
Well, the caller hung up, but you know, hopefully that helps. And if there are other callers, then they can call back and follow up. We do have a couple of other people waiting, so let's go on and talk with an Urbana caller on line number 3. Good morning.
Yes, I recently took an early retirement offer from my local government employer, and I have to choose between two methods of having my pension paid.
Yes.
One pays faster and the other one is slower. The slower one actually accumulates more over 26 years. After 11 years, the cumulative amounts are the same, and I'm just wondering how to think about this or analyze it.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the annuitized benefit indexed for inflation?
It increases 3% each year on the original amount.
Are these both life annuities, either choice? Or life and survivor annuities?
Yes, life and survivor.
All right, so are they joint in 50%? In other words, if you pass away before the other potential annuitant, perhaps a spouse, then that particular spouse would receive 50%?
That's correct.
All right. And are you telling me, and I'm a little unclear, you have to repeat this for me, in other words, you have a choice of a payout, but they both last life. They are both life annuities.
That's right.
All right. And you're saying that in the first 11 years, one of the annuities pays out faster than the other?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me your age?
54.
54.
I do have a full-time job now, so I don't need all of my pension to live on.
Well, based upon, are you in good health?
Yes.
And do you have a long life expectancy in your family?
Pretty good.
All right. Well, then, I think all of the things being equal, and again, I would strongly suggest that you sit down with a financial advisor or an accountant to look at the numbers. But just from what you're telling me, I probably would be leaning toward the longer time period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
All right. So that's what I can tell you just based upon the information that you have given me.
Okay.
But again, I caution you, I would suggest that you strongly do this before you actually sign the final paperwork and make that decision.
I'll do that.
All right, good.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the program.
All right, thanks for the call. A couple other people waiting. We'll go on next to another Urbana listener on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We recently had an opportunity to invest in something called a limited partnership. This particular one operates pipelines for natural gas and petroleum products. In reading the material sent to us about this investment, I noted you buy units instead of shares, and this partnership dissolves, I think, in the year 2087 or something like that. And our accountant said, oh, ask about liquidity for something like this. Could you kind of compare it to a regular individual stock investment?
Well, limited partnerships typically are illiquid investments. Unless the limited partnership agreement has a provision where the general partner will purchase units of a limited partnership. But when you buy limited partnership units, make no mistake, you are buying a security.
Okay.
So you are, under the documents, agreeing when you buy this security that you are not buying it for a rapid turn. You are buying it
correct.
For long term,
that's
and
right.
Indeed, under the SEC rules and regulations, you would be required to hold this particular limited partnership a minimum of 2 years, barring death, before you could even think about negotiating it.
That's not a problem.
All right. So liquidity becomes very important. Now, let me ask you some things about this particular limited partnership.
Okay.
Does the offering memorandum that you have in front of you have a legal opinion?
I have to confess I don't have an offering memorandum. All I have is material sent from the brokerage firm.
Okay. Well, what you should request next from the brokerage firm is an actual offering memorandum.
Oh, okay.
It's an actual prospectus. It's going to be a thick document. It should have a whole bunch of items in it. And probably on the first page, it's going to say that this investment involves a high degree of risk. So you should be a very sophisticated investor. And there is a probability that you could lose all of your money. Every limited partnership in the world says that. Next, it should have a legal opinion in it that it is properly constituted, and it should also address the taxation issues. In other words, are you intending to receive current income from this limited partnership? Is there some kind of income that is being promised?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And how is that income going to be treated? Next, you should look at the track record of the general partner, because in a limited partnership, we have two kinds of partners. We have a general partner who is responsible for all of the liability of the partnership, and then we have the limited partners who are the equity partners, and the most typically that you can lose in a limited partnership is your equity, your investment.
Okay.
All right. Next, you want to look in the limited partnership agreement to see if there is the potential for capital calls, which means that you could get a nasty little letter in the mail and say, hello, we're running a little short this month. Remember that agreement you signed? Well, send us $5,000 immediately to maintain your partnership units. All right? So make certain that you are not privy to any additional capital calls. When I look
capital
at a limited
partnership. Okay. That's something I think I had heard vaguely about many years ago from a relative and was misapplied to regular stock transactions.
Right. But in a limited partnership, you could be privy to a call depending upon the agreement that you're signing. Also, in any limited partnership, I like to see the general partner have money at risk, which means that not only is the general partner the GP, the general partner is also an LP, a limited partner. So the general partner has their own money at risk.
Okay.
There's an old saying in the limited partnership business that I put my money up into the limited partnership, and I gain a lot of experience, and I lose a lot of money. The general partner has a lot of experience and ends up with a lot of money. All right? So be very, very careful. That's not to say that there aren't many, many legitimate, well-run partnerships and limited partnership agreements. Interestingly enough, there aren't as many as there used to be because the choice now is to move away from the limited partnership form of doing business into something called a limited liability company. But a lot of pipeline and gas deals are still of the limited partnership variety. Finally, in the partnership agreement, it should state exactly what the selling commission is. And the selling commission to a brokerage firm is typically in the range of 5 to 10% of the money that you are putting up. And that is troublesome to me. That's very troublesome. When I put a dollar into a limited partnership and 5 to 10% are going for brokerage or selling fees to my broker, I think that's unreasonable. So I'd want to see if the total number of dollars that are being collected, how much are really going into the deal? Because the more money that is going into the deal, the more likely it is to succeed and have serious amounts of cash throw off for me down the road.
I appreciate this very much.
All right. Good luck.
Yep.
Thanks for the call. Our lines are full. We'll go on next to another Urbana listener on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize. I think you've already addressed this earlier, but my grandmother just sold her home, and she wanted to gift some of the money to myself and my mother. And I tuned in a little bit late in the show, and I heard something about a gift to a child or grandchild of up to $55,000. And I know, or at least I had thought that the $11,000 was a maximum before there was any tax penalty. So I guess my question is, which is it? And then what steps? I know a few callers ago, someone asked,
how do you do
keep
it?
A record?
Okay. Here's the answer. Is this your mother or grandmother?
This is my grandmother who sold her home.
Okay. All right. So she sold her home, and I'm going to presume that she took advantage of a special home tax rule, which basically says that if you are single and you sell your home for more than you paid for it and the more than you have in it, the first $250,000 of gain we pay no tax on. Or if you are married, a homeowners together can essentially not pay tax on $500,000 of gain. So I'm going to presume that your grandmother sold her home and she hasn't had to pay any tax on the proceeds. Do you think that's a fair thing to assume?
I think so, because I believe the check was sent straight to her from the realtor and there's been no,
okay,
to my knowledge, there's been no tax paying at all.
Right, and probably, unless she had a really very substantial gain, it was probably less than $250,000.
Oh, yes.
So there would be no tax impact.
Okay.
Now, the next rule is she widowed? Is she married?
She's divorced.
Okay, she's divorced. So she's single.
Yes.
All right. So as a single person, she can take any amount of money up to $11,000 and gift it to as many people as she wants. So she could first gift you $11,000, and she could gift your sister $11,000.
Okay.
Are we talking about two people?
Yeah, my mom and myself.
Okay, your mom and yourself. So that's $22,000.
Okay.
In addition, during one's lifetime, one has the ability, gift tax-free, to gift up to $1 million. Additionally, beyond the $11,000 amounts, and pay no tax. If your grandmother was going to gift beyond the $11,000 to each of you this year, she would have to go to her accountant and have the accountant file a gift tax return, which is really quite simple. It's filed, it's sent in to the Internal Revenue Service, and through some fancy accounting, it will show how much did I gift, what's the gift tax, and it will show a gift tax amount, and then everyone has something called a credit, a unified credit, against gifts made, and basically, to make a long story short, you would owe zero tax. But it's very important that people file gift tax returns if they make gifts in excess of $11,000 to an individual. So if your grandmother's going to gift you more than $11,000, the amount in addition to the $11,000 has to be reported on a gift tax return, but there will be no gift tax typically that will be owed.
Okay, so she would fill out this gift tax return.
She would have her accountant fill it out.
Okay.
And she doesn't want to fill it out herself.
No,
she needs
she doesn't.
To go to an accountant who will know how to do this, and typically, before she makes the gift, she can talk to the accountant to make certain that we're all on the same page. But if it's done properly, there should be no gift taxes, no income taxes to either you or your grandmother.
Okay. And then next year, in my, like if I do get $11,000 this year, the next year in my 2004 taxes, I would have to record.
Absolutely not. You don't record anything. It's your money.
Anything.
It's your money. There's no recordation. You don't pay any tax on it. It's
okay.
Tax-free. Now, when you reinvest that money, and that money, maybe you go down to the bank and put it in a CD, and the CD pays you interest, you do report the interest.
Okay.
You follow that?
Incidentally, yes.
If your grandmother gifted you tomorrow $11,000, come January 1 of 2005, she could gift you another $11,000, because the $11,000 is an annual exclusion. So
okay.
She could gift you $11,000 for the next 25 years, if she wanted to.
Okay, that was my second question there, following question. All right, great. And the name of the, was a gift tax return, was the name of the form we need to have an accountant
right.
submit for?
Right, your accountant will be familiar with that form.
Okay, great. All right, I appreciate your information.
My pleasure.
Okay, thanks for the call. But the $1 million is the lifetime limit.
That's a lifetime limit.
Okay.
So, Jack, what I want you to do is write me a check for $11,000 and then write me another million.
Okay.
Right? So,
okay.
And not with Monopoly checks or play money checks, but I mean the real thing.
I'll have to go get my checkbook after the show.
Thank you, Jack.
Very good. Well, let's go on and talk to some other callers. Next up, someone in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning.
Thank you very much. If someone don't need the money, first of all, you have an IRAs, both Roth and traditional. Is there any argument in favor of taking the money out early or simply waiting until the 70-and-a-half-year age rule goes into effect?
Well, now remember, with a Roth IRA, you never have to take the money out.
Okay.
All right, that's number one. So the Roth IRA can actually go into someone's estate. It would pass to the named beneficiary, and it would be part of your gross estate for estate tax purposes. So there is an issue of what is the size of the estate with respect to a Roth IRA, right? But remember, when you take the money out of a Roth IRA, it is the too good to be true rule. If you wait until at least 59 and a half, you can then take the money out tax-free, not tax-deferred, but tax-free. And if you didn't need it, I suppose you could give it away. All right?
Okay.
Now, with a traditional IRA, remember at age 70 and a half, you must start taking minimum distributions. Those minimum distributions are subject to federal income tax, and they're just simply layered onto your income. So in a sense, you are really paying at your highest marginal tax rate on those IRA distributions. Follow that?
Yes.
All right. So it really becomes a question of tax brackets and where you are today versus where you may be tomorrow. And people yell and scream and argue on both sides of the equation. And the real issue is tax brackets. Are you likely to be in a lower tax bracket at retirement? And the funny thing is, for people who have worked all of their life, have pensions, have Social Security, my goodness, they find themselves not in a lower tax bracket. They basically may well find themselves in the same tax bracket.
Okay,
and the other thing that we have to wonder about is where are tax brackets likely to go in the future? And if I were a betting person, I'm going to bet that they're not going to be lower, that they're likely to be higher. So I hope that helps you sort of stir the soup.
Okay, it does. Thank you very much.
My
Thanks
pleasure.
Very much for the call. We have just about maybe 12 minutes left during this hour, Focus 580, a couple callers, and probably time for others if you'd like to join us. We're talking with David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, doing our monthly program on personal finance. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Another Urbana listener next, on line number 3. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm back to check 21.
Okay.
I guess I'm one of those savvy people who read something in the newspaper several weeks ago and has been worried about it ever since. And I've been trying to talk with my bank about it. They have not yet sent out anything, nor have any of the other banks in which I have checking accounts and write checks. And the question that I have, which nobody seems to answer, and perhaps you don't know either, are the images, if you get them on, and I'm not talking about substitute checks because I think they are something, another animal.
They are.
I'm talking about the fact that my bank has promised that instead of sending me checks, they will send me images.
The electronic image.
On both sides, you know,
yes,
of the check. And what I'm trying to find out and can't get much satisfaction is that legal for the IRS? Should I be audited for my charitable my charitable gifts, my IRS payments, you know, all the other things, a farm and a number of other things for which I keep my checks as in case I'm ever audited for, you know, expenses for the farm, for IRS, paying the IRS, the state taxes and all the other taxes.
Well, let me say this. I don't think there is any legislation specifically that's been promulgated that say electronic images are satisfactory for IRS purposes. But as far as I know, in the audits that I have looked at over the last 5 years, a lot of folks have relied on these electronic images in providing information to IRS. And IRS to date, at least in my experience, has not balked at receiving any of those particular electronic images in lieu of the original check.
Oh, yesterday, I printed out publication 552, which does talk about what records you should keep. And they are a little bit wishy-washy, too, about imaging. They say if your bank doesn't send you your checks, then I guess that's what you rely on. But what's got me concerned is this whole throwing in of this substitute check, which my bank says, okay, I can we can send you that when you request it.
Yes.
And I'm sure they're going to charge me for my request.
Right. Under these regulations, under these laws, they have the right to charge a fee, and there's no limit, as I understand it, so you might have to go bank shopping if you're going to request substitute checks.
Yeah.
In terms of the fee. But the bottom line is, come October 28th, the Internal Revenue Service is not going to have any choice.
They're really not going to have any choice.
Not everybody in America is going to request substitute checks.
Yeah, because, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, get the thing from your charity, the letter, if you're over 250, which I very carefully do.
Yes.
But a friend of mine she didn't have a complete audit, but she had a request, you know, because one year she gave a little bit more to a charity. And they made her, you know, she fortunately was still getting her checks. She was paying a fee to get them.
Sure.
And what happened was, well, the IRS said, well, we those letters aren't enough. We want the front and the back of your canceled check. And so I don't know if we'd never get our checks. We don't have anything but those images, I guess. I mean, I can't see a customer running to your bank every month and saying, give me substitute check for a number 5555 or anything like that.
You're absolutely right. This is going to be very interesting how it's going to play out.
It's just, I think we're at the mercy of some law that we didn't know about. I have another question, and perhaps, again, you can't answer it, but I know a bit about software and hardware obsolescence and preservation of records in that way, and I know how things could be lost, and I just wonder how stable our bank computer systems, if they forget, example, get new hardware, new software, are they going to lose my 7 years, which they are promising me that they're going to have forever and ever? What do you know about the stability of computers?
It's very high. It's very, very high.
One of
the areas that regulators are very, very good at, whether it's state regulators or federal regulators, is the integrity of the hardware and software systems.
Okay.
They are constantly tested, and indeed millions and millions and millions of dollars go into proprietary systems all of the time for banks. And that really is one of the solid parts of our banking system.
Well,
so I feel pretty comfortable with that, absent some type of major, major attack, which can always happen.
Yeah,
but day-to-day, very, very solid.
But do you think the IRS will be issuing some other regulation?
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I don't think so.
Yeah, because the publication, the last time it was revised was 1999.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But thank you for raising these issues.
It's just very hard to get any substantial answers from the bank, although they promise you they're going to do this.
Well, they don't have the answers either, so they'd rather hedge than not say something that's incorrect.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We have several callers. We'll try to get them all in. Next up, someone in Crawfordsville, Indiana, on line number one. Good morning. Is there a caller there?
Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
I have a question about buying municipal bonds.
Yes.
I was told in Monday's business section of the New York Times they have a listing of what's offered that week. And if I could find the advantage of this, if you buy a new issue, that the seller of the bond would pay the commission. And if I find one there listed, like I see a California general obligation.
Yes.
And it'll be by some broker, maybe in New York.
Yes.
If I go to I live in a small town here, like A.G. Edwards or Jones.
Sure.
Would they be able to buy that bond for me?
They have a large cadre of new issue bonds, and they probably could access those bonds for you.
What would my cost be if the seller?
Very little.
Uh-huh.
Very little. $25?
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. I had some CD money coming due, and I thought that might be a way to reinvest that.
If you're going to do that, I want you to buy bonds that are not 30-year bonds.
Sure.
Shorter bonds and GO bonds, general obligation bonds.
Would this be a way to avoid, I have some money in a municipal bond fund, and I would get beat up in a higher interest rate environment. Would this be a strategy to avoid?
This would be a strategy so long as you are willing to hold the bonds to maturity.
Right.
All right?
Right.
Because remember, in a municipal bond fund, they trade, they go up and down every day, so you're taking on interest rate risk.
Okay.
Yes.
But if I hold it, I don't have any risk if I hold it to maturity then.
The only risk you have is default risk, and
right.
you have purchasing power risk because you're getting paid back in cheaper dollars.
Uh-huh. That's why you want the general obligation bond.
Absolutely, right. to deal with default risk, and then you don't want to be out there 20 or 30 years on the maturity curve. That's too much purchasing power and interest rate risk.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, David. Thank you
My pleasure.
Much. Bye.
Okay, thanks a lot. We'll go next to a listener in Mattoon, line number 2. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about just some general financial planning. We have an accountant, but I'm sure you're aware of all the advertisements on television, different financial organizations that can help you with not just retirement planning, but just general
yes.
financial planning. We have is there someone who's the best one to turn to?
Well, I think you want to turn to someone who is certified as a certified financial planner. It's called a CFP. There are literally thousands of them in the country. That means they've taken a regimen of courses. They've been certified. They actually are held to certain ethical standards. And that's where I would start. I would not use a financial planner that was not a certified financial planner, or at least either a lawyer or a CPA.
Can A.G. Edwards or Jones or one of those, is that, or the myriad of others that advertises? Is
well,
that...
a lot of the people who work for those particular brokerage firms are indeed certified financial planners. You can actually go to the Yellow Pages, believe it or not, and look under financial planners, and certified financial planners will be listed with a CFP designation and copyright.
Okay.
That's where I would start.
If the situation involves a small business, would you direct me any other way?
Well, I think small business, you really want to have a cadre of people. You want an accountant involved. You want your lawyer involved. You want your banker involved, and maybe your financial planner. A lot of financial planners are personal financial planners, but they have good information and good advice about small business.
Do most banks have someone on staff that can help you in this way?
Well, I think if you're a small business, you want to have a bona fide banking relationship anyway. So there is certainly someone at the bank who can help you, but they're really not going to do quote unquote personal financial planning
for
you.
Okay. Right. That's understandable. Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. And I'm sorry to say there's one caller left that we're just not going to be able to get to. I apologize to that person. And, you know, what can I say? We're out of time. Our guest has been David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. And he joins us once a month, always on the third Friday of the month from 10 to 11 to take your questions on personal finance. And David Sinnoh, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
Just lots of fun. Just lots of wonderful questions today.
Okay.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. When we return in just a few minutes, we'll be talking with Susan Thistlethwaite, that's easy for me to say, president of the Chicago Theological Seminary. She is the Friday Forum speaker at the University of YMCA at noon, and we'll be talking with her about Christian conflict resolution and differing without demonizing. First, though, we have some news and a market update. With that, AM580's Jay Pierce.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training and